Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me, first and foremost, is a man who is finally enjoying the China dream. With his apartment in Chaoyang District, his lovely wife, his beautiful child, and his golden retriever, all united for the first time in over a year, it's James Hull.
Yeah, thanks. That's all true. Let me get to the disclaimer. This is an educational and hopefully entertainment podcast. We have positions, and we may have positions in the companies that we talk about. We try to say so when we do. Maybe we should do that first before we get going. But that could change after we record. So, you know, no promises here. This is not investment advice. Get your investment advice somewhere else, or better yet, do your own research, and good luck out there.
And today we'll be discussing earnings reports from Baidu, Tencent, and JD. And when we discuss earnings reports, it means that we are joined by a man whose initials are shared with the land of 10,000 lakes. It's Michael Norris. Michael, thank you for joining us again.
Folks, it's great to be back. Thanks for putting up with me and getting the IT rolling. Appreciate it.
Did you get the land of 10,000 rakes, the Minnesota reference? I have a nice streak of you not understanding any of my references.
That's impressive because you're Australian and that's like a U.S. thing, but that's awesome.
Indeed. But I was thinking of the U.S. states that actually have M in them. And I could only arrive at one, which was Minnesota. And so I stayed with that answer.
That's the right one. But there is also Michigan, Massachusetts, Maine, Montana, Missouri, Mississippi. Yeah, there we go. Anyways, let's stop talking about U.S. geography. Techno.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. So we're going to get into three companies today. What do you guys want to go at first? What do you say we do? Want to do Baidu, James?
Yeah, we can do Baidu first. How deep should I go? I mean, maybe I'll start with kind of a ratio comparison. So I did kind of a market cap, free cash flow, and then free cash flow yield for all three of the companies we're talking about today. I also did an EV EBITDA, and I calculated these on my own. I didn't use Bloomberg's numbers for most of the stuff because last time they had it wrong again on Kuaishou. So Baidu's free cash flow yield is about 4.5%. EV to EBITDA is 13. And price to sales is 3.9. Now that compares to JD and Tencent. JD's free cash flow yield is 3.8. Tencent's 3%. EV EBITDA for JD 41.6, Tencent 32.3. And yeah, let's dive into Baidu. Okay, so
I have a question. This is the framing that I have, and I want you to respond to this. So I feel like Baidu is potentially, at least narrative-wise, kind of like Vinyl Records, in that they were like so mainstream, and then they became so out of style. And now they're kind of hipster cool again. Their results have been okay, and they seem to be doing all right. But Wall Street doesn't seem to like them that much.
Okay, so I got a little thing sort of prepared here. I just pulled up my I track metrics on all these companies, and I just pulled up my metric sheet. And this is like the most annoying thing about Baidu, and it's like every year they do it. Sometimes multiple times a year, sometimes once, but they have this thing where they like to kind of change the wording in their earnings releases about what they're talking about, like what their metrics are. So they have they used to disclose daily active users, and last quarter they kind of, not Q1, but Q4 last year, they stopped doing that. And they started to disclose this thing called daily logged in users, which is just the most flimsy of all the metrics you could possibly have. You know, like if you're logged in, like a lot of people a lot of apps just log you in automatically every day, right? It, like, whether you open the app or not, you're still logged in. So, like, for example, last week I was like, okay, let me check out Tieba, like Baidu's Tieba thing. And I downloaded the app, and it was the first time ever opening it, and I was, like, automatically logged into it. So I have the Baidu app, and somehow it knew my phone, recognized my phone, and automatically logged me in, which is, so I must be a daily logged in user. So they don't even tell you the number. They tell you roughly a percentage, and I guess it's a percent of MAU. It's not even that clear. So that's annoying. But in general, kind of zooming out, things do look to be changing. And I would say probably for the better at Baidu. Now, not their little disclosure shenanigans, but in terms of kind of their cloud, their smart traffic thing they call V2X, their autonomous vehicles or AVs, this stuff is kind of looking interesting now. So their non-advertising businesses are growing faster, and they believe that will continue. They also think there's a much higher TAM in these non-advertising verticals. They think they're the leader in AVs, which is kind of, it could be a big market. It's kind of all new. We don't really know. I think they launched the Apollo Go in Beijing, I think it was last year. And I think they started with like maybe 30 robo-taxis. And they're all kind of kept to a very small part of the city where it's like very easy to kind of manage them. And they're like slowly letting them kind of go a little farther out. I've never seen one, and I've asked some friends. I don't know anyone who's seen one, but it would be cool to try it out. I think in AVs, they have an interesting positioning strategy, and that's in this like V2X. Huh. So basically, they have like in their cloud and they have like in all these non-advertising businesses, they have a 2B business. And they have a 2G, which is two government. Basically, the two government part is V2X. It's like vehicle to infrastructure. And basically all it is, that like when Robin Lee talks about it on the earnings call, it makes it sound like it's some amazing infrastructure thing. But I think it's just like traffic light management. They have sensors at traffic lights. They kind of see what the flow is, how congested it is, and then sort of change the traffic flows, and all that's supposedly connected to Baidu Brain. So this is kind of cool because what they do is they go to local governments, they go to cities, and they basically say, all right, we're going to do some traffic lights on this part of the city. And then they do that. And then the local government goes, okay, that's actually working pretty well, but we need to tie up the rest of the city to this. And so they eventually get more of their city on this system. Now, this could lay the groundwork to become kind of an autonomous vehicle infrastructure platform where it's not just like cameras and sensors looking at the cars, but maybe the cars also communicating with this like V2X infrastructure.
Yeah, I was at the big Baidu annual conference. I think it was like late 2018, early 2019. Sorry if I'm missing the details here, but this is something that they've been promoting for a very long time. That like the future of Baidu is autonomous vehicles. It is the smart kind of traffic grid. And this is one of these things that like, I don't really know what to think about it because yeah, it's like, it sounds great, but what is the actual TAM there and how soon can it finally be realized? That's just something that I don't really see.
It's going to take forever, I'm sure. Governments move really slow. But what's interesting about this to me is if they have the autonomous vehicle infrastructure there, that is basically going to be like a utility. It's going to be like a natural monopoly where, you know, maybe there's some other autonomous vehicle operating systems, but if they're connecting to the infrastructure in like the roads, in the highways, in the traffic lights, they're going to have to use Baidu's and they're going to probably have some sort of you know, it's not going to be high margin, I'm sure. It's going to be low margin, which all utilities are low return, you know, very stable, but low return kind of businesses. I think all of their 2G, also just because of the way the local governments work, it's all going to be low margin. It's kind of the same thing with their 2B as well, though, because a lot of their 2B clients that they've kind of talked about are kind of like Postal Savings Bank, you know, these big banks that are signing up for their finance AI cloud. I mean, these are SOEs, and they are the same thing. They, you know, they move really slow. They don't like paying. They don't like price increases. You know, sometimes they don't pay. And so they, you know, Baidu's already bringing up on their earnings call in this quarter that they're like starting to have allowance for bad debt as they work with 2G and 2B, like some of these SOEs. So, you know, there is definitely a big opportunity there. Now the higher margin stuff is going to be like, instead of two SO, you know, if you break 2B into two parts, two SOE and two private, you know, the two private part, you know, Minqi is going to be the higher margin stuff. And that's, I'm sure they'll find something. They basically have, you know, when you look at their cloud positioning, they talk about, when they ask questions about this, they talk about the tasks, the like machine learning tasks that everybody kind of does, which are, you know, natural language processing, NLP, recommendation, tagging, smart, you know, like looking at video and tagging the video, looking at photos, tagging the content. In finance, you know, it's going to be like looking for probably, you know, bank transfers that look sketchy and trying to catch, you know, fraud or graft or something.
What comes to my mind here is that the idea of Baidu for a very long time, it has been, you know, this is kind of played out, but that they're the Google of China. I think this is something that they aren't, and I think most savvy investors don't see them as that. But now, is it almost as like they're making a play for something like the Verizon of the next generation, as this sort of like crucial infrastructure that may have some sort of kind of quasi monopoly or may kind of own a certain kind of layer within that tech stack that that is essential and is not going to have huge margins, but is,
well, I mean, comparing it to mobile, you know, mobile phones you're selling to consumers, and if there's not many other options with service in their area, I mean, it's basically a monopoly, and they can charge consumers whatever they want. And so you saw before there was some sort of break, you know, antitrust on in those areas, you did see kind of some price gouging of consumers, and you kind of see it right now with cable. You know, I think the big questions for me with Baidu are with their non-advertising stuff, which is definitely the more interesting stuff. It's definitely the higher TAM, less competition. You know, I mean, they have plenty of competition in cloud, but in terms of AVs, I do think they're probably quite a bit farther ahead. I just don't think we're all going to be riding robo-taxis in the next 3 years. Mm. I think it's going to take a little longer, but they might argue with that. I don't know. So my questions are, will the 2G segment pay up? And I'm kind of doubtful of that. Will the SOEs, you know, the 2B pay up for their, you know, services, banks, utilities, power utilities, these things? I kind of doubt it. And then how much can they charge for robo-taxis? When they launched in Beijing, they were free. And I think Beijing just in the last 6 or 9 months started allowing them to charge very small amounts. So, you know, what's that going to look like? And then lastly, I think we've talked about on the podcast so many times, I worry about the culture at Baidu and whether they can attract and keep high-end talent. You know, they did mention that they need to hire a lot of salespeople. If they want to go and build out this services business, they're going to need a lot of salespeople. to be honest. I mean, what I've heard about the way they run things over there is that Robin Lee's kind of mercurial. He's kind of a micromanager. He likes having authorship of ideas and stuff like that. You know, that all that stuff isn't great when you're dealing with high quality developers, probably, but maybe it works for salespeople. So maybe that, maybe that'll work. I don't know. But definitely what will help with developers as well as salespeople is a higher share price for options. So, you know, if people are making money, they can kind of just keep their head down and grind. But if not, then it's just tougher. So, I mean, I like in terms of valuation, like I said in the beginning, Baidu is clearly the cheap, you know, in terms of these ratios, EV to EBITDA and free cash flow yield of the three we're talking about today. And Baidu's, I mean, it's not going away. I mean, there's you have very low risk of that. They're so tight with government and SOEs. I have a very hard time thinking they're going to get, you know, as Michael calls it, SAMR colonoscopy.
But it seems to me that the one thing that we are not, or we can't, that we probably shouldn't expect from them is high margin, high growth, but we should not expect them to go away either. So it seems as though they're a value play.
Yeah, they still have iQIYI, and I'm just bearish on iQIYI. I just can't see this. I don't know. They're subscribers are just, like we've talked about, really finicky. They come on, they leave. They peaked last year Q1 in subscribers, and they haven't been able to top that in the last four quarters. So and they're still a whole 13 million below where they were. I have a tough time. There was a lot of questions on Baidu, though. One of them was, that I can just quickly address, why is Baidu search ad business revenue declining? So the thing about their, you know, all these companies have quite a bit of seasonality, and you can see the seasonality if you just look at sequential change, you know, quarter on quarter change in their revenue for each segment even. And what you see when you do that with online marketing services is every Q1, there's a negative bar. If you just chart it or put it on, you know, put it in a graph. Last year was really bad. It was a negative bar on sequential and a negative bar on year over year. This year, it's much smaller. It's still down like, 13%. But year over year, it's up 27%. So Baidu still is going to have some growth. You know, will it average out? I mean, this quarter, year over year, was up 25%. If I look at the last seven quarters, year over year, the highest was 6%. And most of them were like around 1 or 0. You know, one was 5, and then there was a negative 7. So, I mean, it's just not, it's like they've been messing up. They've lost, you know, they tried to do all this stuff with Haokan. They're trying to kind of rebuild their Baidu app ecosystem and keep people in there. And it's just not as interesting. Baidu app is just not as interesting as Douyin and Kuaishou.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And WeChat. It's just they shouldn't try to keep people in their ecosystem. Just give them what they want, you know, like charge for the search and then go and do all these other things you've been investing in for so long. And maybe pay your developers better. I don't know. Like,
yeah, I mean, Baidu's sex appeal is that of a giant Ziploc bag full of lard. Like, it's not a when it comes to the attention grabbing aspect of their business. We had some questions about this from our followers on Twitter. This is just something that I feel like we can't really count on them to do, because if you're trying to compete with Kuaishou and ByteDance, you're not going to be able to do that. It doesn't seem to be in Baidu's DNA. What is in Baidu's DNA is staying alive and these sort of kind of long-term, you know, government relationships, state-owned companies, you know, kind of trying to establish their spot within the next generation of core digital infrastructure, which I think they at least seem to be. I don't know if they are doing a good job at it because we're not seeing the results yet, but they at least seem to be focusing on it, and that's about it, as good as I can and say about them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's, unless some people want to raise their hand and ask some questions, I think that's all I got. Anything to add, Michael?
So a disclosure on my part, over the course of this quarter, one of Baidu's IR people reached out. I haven't had a chance to appraise myself of what they actually sent me until preparing for this call. But here's what they had to say about the highlights in Q1.
Okay.
And I'll read selectively from this because some of it is corporate bullshit. A note to all the IR people out there, please don't do this because I will say how I call it. But the interesting stuff is as follows. Baidu has beaten Wall Street's expectations for 5 quarters in a row. And then I looked up the current guidance that was given in the following quarter, and I found it to be quite conservative. The reason for that is that the guidance that they gave on the call does not include the contribution from YY, the live stream service that they recently acquired. So although I'm not a great fan of linear extrapolation, it does look like Baidu has set itself a low bar and may extend that streak from 5 to 6. Continuing on, with respect to some of the highlights around voice and driving, one of the things that caught my eye was that the install for the voice, so it's the D-U-E-R, yes, indeed, OS. So when it comes to installs for new cars, and so this powers the dashboard, so your dashboard with the Duer OS is able to come to life and be an interactive dashboard, or as they say, powering infotainment. And the installs for new vehicles, 1.5 million new vehicles, and recorded Q1 installation is double from the prior year. So what it looks like.
But what does double mean?
That's right. So you start from, or you've got a foothold in the car, and as James pointed out, you have a foothold in the traffic infrastructure as well. And all of this.
Imagine if they had a Tencent Music's, you know, library they could like stream through that.
yeah, seriously.
So they've got the pieces for transport, and like James said, whether it's on the call or whether in the statements, the team over at Baidu are quite bullish on the transport opportunity. To echo the comments that Baidu's CFO, Herman Yu, made on the call, is that transport is 16% of China's economy. His numbers, not mine. There's no reference. Take it with a pinch of salt. And he goes on to say, thus, AI platforms that power smart transportation, autonomous driving, and in-vehicle infotainment working in tandem can bring incredible operating efficiencies, convenience, as well as improve traffic safety, reduce carbon emissions for the transportation sector. That, I think, is the crux of where this non-ad revenue, which is now 21% of Baidu Core, is going. That they're attacking this transport theme from a couple of different angles. And for those on the call that are familiar with some of the other China tech giants that are moving into big areas like agriculture or what have you, this theme of attacking a big vertical and coming at it through the consumer side and through the infrastructure side and the tech stack, I think is we're starting to see that across a couple of different Chinese players. And you have to give them credit. This is a space where it doesn't look like there's too many players at scale. As James said, the lock-in ability for this sort of infrastructure appears quite strong. So power to them. as a way of weaning themselves off of stagnating digital advertising revenues and turning into something a little bit different. That's all that I had to say.
Okay.
With the disclosure that some of those data points were given to me by a representative at Baidu.
Okay. All right. Well, anyways, Michael, I want to stick with you, and I want to actually close up the Baidu segment here and move on to Tencent. So Tencent, as far as I can see, they had both top line and bottom line growth. Things seem to be going quite well for them. Wall Street investors don't seem to be responding. I think that it seems, at least from looking at the headlines right now, that investors are very concerned about how regulators may take on Tencent at this current moment. What is your take on this, Michael?
So I agree that you've got the regulatory overhang right now, and I also agree that Tencent posted some very strong results. So let's talk a little bit about the regulatory overhang first. So Tencent, for those that are following the numbers and counting the beans, has lost around $200 billion in market capitalization since January. Whether it's Tencent or whether it's some of the other players that have been named or fingered as potential candidates for the antitrust colonoscopy, they all have a similar fate. And I should just say, for listeners who are new to the antitrust colonoscopy term, what I mean by that, I mean that it is a flexible, uncomfortable probe that may or may not happen on a semi-regular basis, depending on what they find. So I think that the overall metaphor is quite apt, and I'm sticking with it, irrespective of whether it gives you a funny tummy or not. Now, on to Tencent. So a 25% increase in top-line revenue to $20.6 billion, a 65% increase in profit to $7.3 billion, and with the profits, Tencent, joining some of its other tech titans, has said that they're going to commit to investing a larger portion of those incremental profits into a couple of key focus areas, those being 1, cloud services, 2, video content, and 3, games. The reason given on the call was that the pandemic plus Tencent's execution success has given them confidence in cloud services, video content, and games, and they're looking to pull forward the future by investing incremental profit into those three areas. And I think that that broadly makes sense. If you have a look at cloud services, they had one of their strongest quarters on record. So the cloud services is lumped in with fintech and business services, which is now a 39 billion RMB business in that quarter, growing at 47%. When it comes to the video content, it is difficult to be able to pass how Tencent's doing exactly, because some of its properties, like Tencent Video, they do give the numbers for, but some others, such as WeChat Channels, which is their short video property, they're a little bit more hush-hush about. And then for games, Tencent managed quite a difficult comps, remembering, of course, that Q1 was the COVID quarter.
Yeah.
A lot of staying at home, a lot of game playing, and they managed to beat that and add 17% to their game top line revenue, sitting now at 43.6 billion RMB. And so looking to pull forward the future, I thought that the call itself, touching on a few of these different issues, whether it's investment, whether it's regulatory overhang, had a lot of confidence to it. So there was a pretty classic slide that I shared on Twitter, which essentially laid out how Tencent's doing across all of its different business areas, and it was a real show of strength. I think just Being able to come over some of those numbers, let me try and find this bloody thing. And while I find it, I will quickly talk about some of the regulatory overhang. I think Martin Lau, Tencent.
I have a question about this because we've had a few questions about this as well. And full disclosure, I have done and still do a series of different work with Tencent and its subsidiaries. So I am not.
And I'm long.
You know, I'm not entirely unbiased. But what we are being asked here by a number of our followers is about regulation. And it seems to me that Tencent has played its cards in a way that by kind of having a small finger in every pie, it seems to stay under the radar. But the one area where it has a much bigger presence than just one finger, I think, would be either gaming or messaging. But I want to hear your thoughts on that, Michael.
So I think that from the regulatory standpoint, at the moment, Tencent Music is under the spotlight. For those that have a sense of history with Tencent Music, they dodged a bullet a few years back with a SAMR investigation that fizzled, not so now. And so there are, I think, a few issues to be unpacked across Tencent Music. And then with respect to the financial element, Martin Lau, I thought, gave really good commentary. He said, and I quote, "There's quite a bit of focus on making sure that there's not going to be systemic risk. We are very focused on compliance with risk management, where there is self-restraint in terms of the size of our non-payment financial products, especially on the lending side." And so what I think you're seeing here is that whether it's Alipay or whether it's WeChat Pay, both have been given the tap on the shoulder to say, "We're here to avoid a Minsky moment. Please do your part." And of course, the language is probably not as nice as that. It's probably something along the lines of, yes, and probably something in the lines of, pull your heads in. But much of the regulatory from the financial side is around that. And so the question, or the only open question for the Tencent financial business, is whether or not the authorities will ask it to be placed in a financial holding company, which is a similar solution, air quotes, that they have given Alipay with respect to its restructuring. And on that point, again, Tencent's president, Martin Lau, was quite confident that Tencent would be able to work with those particular regulations. And so the question, I think, for the regulatory overhang is, like you said, Elle, what parts of the business are in the spotlight? And then following from that, what's Tencent's ability to be able to roll with the punches, adjust to the new regulatory landscape? And although past performance is not indicative of future performance, how Tencent handled previous gaming regulation, I think, is a fair indicator that they have an experienced, savvy commercial compliance division that may very well have grown over this period of time. And I think that they are perhaps better placed to be able to navigate some of these challenges. I'm not going to say that the colonoscopy won't be uncomfortable, but some folks are able to roll off the bed and get going pretty quickly after that procedure. And I would say that Tencent is one of those candidates. My two cents.
Yeah, the obviously I'm biased, but the takeaway I've had in my time either focusing or with Tencent is how their focus does seem very much to be on risk management. I mean, this is something that Martin Lau said in the call. We're very focused on risk management. We're very self-restrained in terms of size, some of our financial products, especially the lending side, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something that if you look at, for example, another example is their investments abroad. If you look at Alibaba has run into CFIUS issues, Huawei, obviously. Tencent seems to have 5 to 10% of so many of the top internet companies around the world, whether it be Snap or whether it be Tesla or whether it be, you know, name the gaming company. It does seem as though when it comes to dealing with regulators, Tencent does seem to be a step or two ahead. And this could be just my own perception, but this does seem to be how they look at things. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I'm long Tencent, so obviously I'm, I guess, biased. I mean, when I look at this, I agree with what Mike was saying about how the colonoscopy is going to be a little different for Tencent. They seem to be, you know, if you look at what the focus of these antitrust, kind of the prohibited practices, you know, this Arshuangyi, you know, pick one from two kind of stuff. And then also, I mean, it's about fintech and it's about the financial side, a la what happened to Ant, right? So Tencent has kept their financial side, especially their lending and their wealth management, they've kept it small. They haven't grown like crazy. And that allows them and I think Tai Xin broke the story that regulators do want them to break that off into a financial holding company. And so if they do, it's going to be, I think, a little bit easier instead, you know. But what the ultimate goal is with this, you know, you have to read the tea leaves for, you know, quite a bit, and it's, you know, it's up in the air. It's like licking a finger what they're trying to do here. But it seems like they don't like tech and finance. They don't like fintech. They don't like them together.
The regulators, you mean?
Yeah, the regulators. So, you know, when I look at Tencent, I see, you know, I basically look at what hasn't changed, what could be changing, and what is changing. And what hasn't changed is that Tencent's WeChat, Weixin is still kind of the dominant social chat app, super app, whatever you want to call it. Tencent is obviously very dominant in games domestically and internationally. Their investment portfolio, I mean, all these other companies have investments, and Tencent is by far the most successful and the largest. So they probably started where everyone else started, you know, doing a little bit here and there, and they just were better at it, and they just kept knocking it out of the park. Compare that, I mean, JD hasn't done as well. I mean, Baidu had Kuaishou, and I guess they had a big return on that. But anyway, what could be changing is payments. We've talked about it before, but it's worth repeating. Payments could get disrupted by the ERMB, the DCEP, whatever we want to call it. And this could mean that their ecosystem, which right now includes their own payments, could change to the same ecosystem, but with ERMB payments.
Well, this is the question that I have, is that if they are just able to, because they're so diversified, if they make they can adapt to this in a way that I think, for example, Ant would really struggle with, is that they could say, okay, yeah, sure, but they're still the processor of it,
The if you want to compare Tencent and Ant, Tencent, you know, payments and all that, It's very different. Ant went very, very hard into lending, and they grew very fast, and in growing very fast, they, you know, broke some stuff. You know, if you run through trying to go fast through the market, you're going to like knock some stuff over, and they piss some people off. I've said it so many times on the podcast, it kind of feels weird repeating it over and over again, but the banks do not like Ant. They do not like Alipay because they, you know, they took so many deposits away from them. It was the first kind of big thing they didn't like. And then Ant was making so much money and the banks were making very little money and putting up most of the capital, right? So they just don't like it. So whatever is going on behind the scenes, Ant lost all the support they had, they got screwed. Okay. Tencent, because they're smaller, they're going to have to change, I'm sure. I have no doubt they're going to have to make some changes. Now, the question is, when they make those changes, what does that mean to their ecosystem? Is their ecosystem with ERMB payments still strong, close to as strong as when they had their own payment system in there? And I think, to me, it's like, you know, I think they're probably 90% there because they have so many users there. They have so much time spent there.
And they have it tied into so much other functionality, whether it be games or messaging, et cetera.
Yeah. So you have, I mean, the ad inventory potential is like huge. They're still extremely careful about it. They have the luxury of being so because they have so much profit from their games. And that's kind of allowed them to have this flexibility. So yeah, then the question is, you know, I just kind of said it, but does it affect their business services? And I think not really. They still have this social network. They still have all those users. They still have all those interactions and potential ad inventory, I think. I mean, there's just so much there they can do with it. And then what is definitely changing is they're becoming a financial holding company. Regulators haven't specified exactly what that means and what they have to do. This is the way the regulators work. They're like, we want to see what you think you should do. You know? and then you tell us your plan and we're going to tell you if that's right or not. You know, it's like, fix yourself. And then, okay, what should I do? It's like, you tell me, you know, you go ahead.
Well, it's self-criticism style of regulation.
It's really nice being a regulator in that sense. Cause I mean, imagine like if that was an investment bank, there would be a whole bunch of analysts having to put together decks upon pages and pages and pages of just meaningless decks of like what should be done, what the company should do. And no one would look at it. And like there'd be all this work that's done. And anyway, but if it was from a regulator, they would look at it. But there, no one's doing that there. Yeah. So they're going to be a financial holding company, or at least that the fintech part, payments part. China tech internet businesses are basically across the board going for growth over profit. That is, I think, an okay thing because there's still a huge and growing pie in China. It's one of the few places in the world that has that. I mean, it's hard to go for growth in the U.S. Over profit. I think most people want you to keep the profit and keep growing. But in China, everyone's kind of, you know, it's a land grab. So they're Tencent, where are they spending? What are they doing? They're investing in cloud, which I think is good. They're investing in short video, which I'm like, you know, I don't quite get it. And then they're investing in something that's even more bizarre, but maybe it's just checking kind of regulatory boxes. It's this thing called sustainable social value. They have a slide on it in their earnings deck.
Well, I'll tell you what sustainable social value is. I mean, that's complying with regulators. That's making an attempt to be the company that Beijing wants them to be. That's what it is, essentially, right? That it's being a good corporate citizen in 2021 China and trying to check all these boxes. And this is something that I think Tencent has always been very, very focused on, very, you know, kind of sensitive about.
I don't watch video. I don't watch TV really that much. But I opened up Tencent's video just to kind of see what they're talking about, what they're trying to do. And actually, I mean, I was pretty impressed. I mean, right in WeChat, you don't have to download another app or anything. You click the Discover button and you can watch movies and TV shows like right there in WeChat. Which I think is what everyone does when you walk around a kind of deserted mall and you see the people that work there, they're all just watching movies and you know, videos on the front. That must be what they're doing.
Or they're on Byte, they're on Douyin.
Like, yeah, or that, or playing games. But they talk about that they want to build out user-generated content and they want to build tools operating procedures and monetization tools, which is the same stuff that Kuaishou talks about. I'm sure if ByteDance was public, they'd talk about it too. But they want that UGC to become PUGC, professional user generated content, which is what Bilibili has, and they've spent years building it. So I'm kind of like, you know, this is, you know, it's a good idea, I guess, because PUGC is cheaper. You know, you pay for the development tools, you pay for the operating procedure, you know, the R&D behind all that, you pay for all, it's just R&D up front. And then you have a platform on which you have a bunch of users creating content that you don't have to pay for. It's the key to that.
So, but it also, it does seem to be a situation where, depending on the platform and depending on the type of content you have, it seems to be one player will dominate it, right? The way that, you know, ByteDance and Kuaishou kind of seem to dominate short video, right? That gaming Tencent dominates, right? That, you know, it is one of these sort of one size or one player or two player kind of takes all when it comes to that. So the question that I would have there is what are these fields? You know, they say short video, they say gaming, but each of these are have different TAMs and different there's different value in each of them, and I guess we can't go into them at the moment, but
I think part of it, if you just take a bigger, like, zoom out and just look at time spent on the user, they just don't want the user going to those other apps. And I kind of get it, but I also kind of don't. So, like I said with Baidu, like, give the users what they want when they come, which they're kind of doing with Baidu is doing with creating all that content that's, like, informative. You know, they did also mention they want to have in this user generated content, they want it to be more like nutritious, is I think the word they used, rather than
compliant.
Yeah, so it's compliant. Yeah, but like, they want it to be, you know, professional knowledge, you know, expertise, you know,
kind they don't want to get in trouble.
Yeah.
Anyways, but on the Tencent thing, Michael, do you have anything that you want to add on Tencent?
Really quickly, no. I'm conscious of time. I think we can leave it for another day. But in terms of Tencent, looks like a pretty good start to the year.
Good. Mike, James, anything you need to close up with quick before we move on to JD?
We should probably just move on to JD.
Okay.
So we had a lot of questions on JD.
James, go ahead.
It might be better to just go to those, but I'll just quickly, you know, go through the metrics here. Annual active accounts almost like hit 500 million. The revenue, you know, average revenue per active account, it just kind of keeps going up pretty steadily. It did take a little dips back in Q4 19, Q1 20, but right now it's 1,600 RMB per active account. Let's see, product revenues, 175 billion, service revenues, 27.9 billion. That's about 15% of total or 14% of total, which has a very nice steady increase. You know, if we go back to Q1 18, it was 9%. Q1 19, it was 10%. Q1 20, it was 11%. And now it's 14% of total revenues. So they did IPO their logistics business, which they own. There was a question about it. Could you buy the ADR in the US and still get exposure? Yes, you can. The ADR company owns 64%, I think. Maybe double check that. Yeah, so they're growing their not product revenues. You know, they're not 1P business. They have a 1P business and a 3P business. 1P is basically like Walmart. You know, they buy stuff, they put it in their own warehouses, or they, you know, they get it on consignment or something like that, and then they put it in their warehouses and then they sell it, and then they have massively high costs of revenues. So their gross profit is lower. You know, their gross margin trailing 12 months is 14.4%. they just can't get this thing higher. I mean, it's like it hasn't really budged in the last 3 years. So, you know, even though they are increasing the service, this is the thing that kind of confuses me about JD. It's like, I think they should increase their gross margin should be increasing. And maybe what they're doing is they're using this service kind of high, which should be higher gross margin, and they're using it to sell their goods at even cheaper prices because it's just such a competitive business that they're in. Might be the case. There was another question about why they're valued as a no growth company, and that could be it. If they could get this gross margin up, I feel like they would. If they could get it to like 18 or 20, or just show kind of a nice inflection in that, I mean, I think they'd be valued much higher.
I gotta say my opinion on JD has dramatically shifted since we started this podcast, which was, I guess, about 2 years ago, right? Is that like we started right in the middle of kind of when Richard Liu had his old situation. There was a lot of kind of volatility going on, not just with JD, but with a lot of e-commerce in China. And, you know, I was a little bit bearish, but it just seems to me that especially when we look at JD's competitors and the other players in the market, like JD just seems to have the substance. They're the broccoli. You know, they're priced like a low growth company, but they just seem to be making to usually make the right moves, and they continue to have just this really strong brand value in China. And I'm kind of converted, I guess, if I'm going to give my own personal opinion, not investment advice.
It is a high growth company. I mean, year over year revenues on a trailing 12-month basis, you know, to make this even more smooth, is like 33%. So you're looking at over the last, I mean, it's always above 20%. It's usually above 25%. It's like very stable growth. The reason why it's valued low is because their margins are so low. I mean, they're like operating trailing 12 months, you know, smoothing this out a little bit, you know, getting that, because there is seasonality in their business too. There's seasonality in just about every one of these businesses. It's like 1.5%. How high can it get? That was another question we got. And it's probably the most important question. Long-term JD margins, what do you think about, you know, how can they get it up? And they basically Porter Five Forces this thing. I mean, there's so much competition. Every merchant, you know, we have to think about antitrust and monopoly, anti-monopoly stuff.
Yeah.
Because that exclusivity that Arshuangyi, you know, pick one from two, which like everything's like two or three businesses, and you have to, every platform makes merchants pick which one to be on. If that's going away, that's going to have big implications. That means merchants. So for example, you know, I was looking at JD. I also went and read Farfetch's, which is not a, you know, China company, but they operate in China, and they think about 50% of their future growth is in China.
And they have a big partnership with JD as well.
Well, JD invested in them, and then they did use JD's, you know, merchant platform, but guess what? They quit.
Oh, really? I didn't know
quit
that.
JD, and they moved to Tmall, and this Q1, they just launched on Tmall, and they were like, they said on the call, I mean, this sounds really bad for JD, and I actually like JD. Like, I think there's some interesting stuff there, but this sounds bad for JD. They said that Tmall luxury platform, TLP, basically multiples of JD's launch.
Huh.
And that they're getting a broader, more diverse group of consumers. They're bringing like 3,000 brands to Tmall luxury platform, which is a huge long tail that needs lots and lots of diversity of users, right? So Tmall's got, I mean, Alibaba has like the most dominant position in e-commerce in China by far. That's like, I think just about everybody, you know, so many people want to create Tmall. That's what JD's trying to do with this merchant 3P business, is trying to create like a Tmall business. But, you know, they do have an amazing logistics business, and it's so amazing. I mean, you can go on Taobao and buy something, and if you want, you can message the seller and be like, hey, can you use Jingdong Logistics to send me this thing? And they'll say yes, because you'll get it tomorrow. And that's like better than, you know, or you can do Xuanfeng. You have to pay more for this, by the way, but they'll do it. So this, you know, JD Logistics is basically, you know, like a third party logistics business. It's totally that way. Now, complicating this luxury problem is Louis Vuitton. Actually, in Q1, JD announced, and probably because they know that Farfetch was leaving, Louis Vuitton signed with JD, and they're, you know, they talked about how great their logistics is. There's even a Vogue business piece that was written. It very much a puff piece for JD Logistics in the luxury category, which I liked it. It's a good piece. It just didn't address a couple things, and that's like, what do luxury brands, you know, what value do they place on logistics compared to other parts of the business that they need, like such as access to customers, you know, that broad, diverse, new, repeat customers, that long tail opportunity, ability to avoid heavy discounting, which is a problem in fashion retail, and then the ability to convert customers from the platform that they're selling on to their own ecosystem, and then therefore own the relationship. And there's probably more. I didn't think of them right now, but so I think there's JD Logistics. I mean, it's on a operating income. I think it's, if you add back in the property sales, I think it's positive. And I think the adjusted number for 2020 was positive, but I haven't looked closely, so go check that out. But I do think JD Logistics is interesting. I think JD is also interesting just because they're still, you know, they're still expanding into lower tiers. There's probably a very long-term growth runway there in terms of those users. First of all, getting more users. Second of all, those users that they get at the lower tiers, increasing their disposable income, and then buying more stuff. And then eventually, you know, as they move from probably like a lower kind of tier, cheaper, you know, price sensitive platform like Pinduoduo to a higher, you know, quality in a way. I mean, it's harder to control quality when you go more 3P. So we'll see how JD does with that.
Yeah, it's the big question with me is that they've spun off so many different parts of their business that, like, while I like JD altogether, the question is like, well, like, what the logistics business, the, for someone like me who is a, I think a little bit more like the average retail investor who's not going as deep into, you know, the numbers, is like, well, how do I differentiate the prospects of JD Logistics versus JD Health versus JD itself? But anyways, that's a much bigger question. But Michael, I want to hear your takes on this.
So just going over some of the questions that we get commonly asked. So the first point around, why is JD valued as a no growth company? And my smart ass answer to that would be, it's valued as a retailer.
Yeah, like a physical store retailer.
It's Walmart. It's Target.
Yeah, exactly. And as you can appreciate this from their earnings presentation, slide four, they've got them top 10 listed retailers in China. JD number one. Top 10 listed retailers in the U.S. Amazon number two. Now, what happens when you look at both of those companies is that you find that some retailers aren't like the others, and that JD has had a CAGR of 30, or its revenues had a CAGR of 30% from the period 2016 to 2020. And guess what? Amazon has had a similar CAGR, 31% over the same period. Now, you compare that with the rest of the comparator mix, and you can see that these two businesses are head and shoulders above their competition in terms of that revenue CAGR growth. But importantly, JD is not putting itself in the same table as platform businesses. Instead, it's only selected the first-party retailers, the ones that actually buy in inventory, sell their own inventory. And what you find is that the valuation, at least from my read of things, anchors around that particular comparative set. Now, what is interesting about JD's spin-off of various different businesses, whether it's logistics, whether it's health, or whether it's the maybe sometime kind of sort of about JD Digits, the finance element.
Technology.
They renamed it. Yes. Is that the individual parts of the business, especially JD Core Retail and New Initiatives, should get a fresh pair of eyes with those spin-offs. And what you would hope if you were an investor in JD is that these spin-offs allow you to wriggle out of the conglomerate tax, this idea of the sum of parts valuation for these industrial or internet conglomerate always tends to be at a bit of a discount, and you hope that gets revisited. There's no certainty there, but that's what I would consider as something on the cards in the next 12 months as JD continues or spins off, I think, what would be the final one in the set, which is the finance division. Okay, next in terms of common questions is, well, what comes next? And I think that there was a semi-symbolic, semi-financial window dressing shift this quarter where new businesses got pulled out of JD Retail, and they reported the revenue and the operating income separately for those businesses. That's important because we were talking about margin before. It perhaps shows the strength of JD Retail's margin, or paints it in the best possible light, and as well as able to show some of the progress that they're making for top-line revenue growth for the new businesses centered on lower-tier consumers, Jingxia, and it's a group buying variant, Jingxia Pinpin. And so what you're able to see and appreciate is that new business is growing quite quickly. If you read some of the color and commentary around JD's community group buying initiatives and initiatives for lower tier consumers, they are working with different pieces of the puzzle in ways that are a little bit more interesting. So some of the folks on the call would appreciate that JD operates convenience stores, so physical retail locations, some of which have connection to the community group buying. And so you've got a nice brand reinforcing mechanism of, okay, well, you do your thrice weekly shop at this, or you pick up a couple of things from the JD convenience store that's in your neighborhood, and guess what? There's this other offer to group buy some other things and pick them up from the same place that you're quite familiar picking up odds and ends from. And I think that's a slightly different proposition from some of the other community group buying platforms where it's, oh, hey, go to this random mom and pop convenience store that you've never been to in your life. It's apparently around the corner from where you are, go and check it out and pick up your a community group buy groceries or some of the staples that they sell through.
Typed in real quick and got the operating income margin for JD Retail, and it's, you know, last year March 31, 2020, 3.7. This year March 31, 2021, Q1 is 3.95. So it is a lot higher, but that's just taking out all their operating loss making businesses that they own a controlling stake in and they have to include in their reporting. So, I mean, JD Logistics, if they sell this thing down, which, by the way, they can't do until November 28th, there's a lockup, they could get rid of potentially a operating loss making business and increase their operating margin. That would be, you know, that would be one way to do it. They could also, you know, the way to break the conglomerate, like Mike, like what you said, it's a very good point. Way to break the conglomerate discount is to get out of the conglomerate, you know, focus on what's your core strength. Logistics is, I mean, it's an amazing business, but in terms of profitability, I mean, it's going to take a while. You know, they need to, they have to run it like a real logistics, you know, third party logistics business. And maybe JD is getting a cheaper price on the goods that they sell through their own logistics group, but I'm not really sure. You know, that would be an interesting research question to try to tackle. Someone also asked if we're going to do another question, JD Logistics moat compared to Tainiao. I mean, they're very different, right? But if we just kind of step back and think, you know, what kind of moat can you have in a logistics business? Typically, it's a network, like in terms of nodes, you know, warehouse distribution centers, warehouse being like the big one, and then the distribution centers being closer to the end user, the end customer, and then maybe even another one that's even closer. I mean, there's like layers of network nodes and the efficiency operating between those nodes. And if you, I don't know, read Peter Drucker, I mean, he's going to tell you that operating efficiency is not a moat. It's not a competitive advantage. Now, having those locations, if there's not a lot of other locations that are easily, you know, grabbed in those areas, so dense cities would maybe be more difficult to expand. I don't know, because I mean there's too much office space, there's too much retail, like malls in China are having a time. I doubt that there's would be difficulty if someone today wanted to start a logistics business and had to invest a lot of money. If they had a blank check, I think they could do it. And probably if they hired a lot of really smart people, get pretty close to what JD has. So I don't think there's much of a moat. The moat that they would have would probably come from kind of a demand aggregation type of thing, a la, you know, Ben Thompson, with their connection to the platform to sell things on JD Retail. Now, like, is that as good as Tmall and Taobao? No. Is it better than Pinduoduo? Maybe. I mean, you probably get better margins selling on JD than you do on Pinduoduo if you take out any promotions that you're able to, you know, subsidies you're able to get. You know, so I like it because I don't think someone's going to come in with a blank check and try to copy it. It would be a big hassle. It would definitely cost a lot of money, and they could do it. It's not impossible. Like the best moats, when you ask that question, they're literally impossible, or like very close near to impossible. So I mean, compared to Tainiao, it's probably better because it was built inside of JD over the years. Tainiao was kind of this, it was acquired by Alibaba. And I've visited a couple Tainiao, like Yijian, and they're very much like Chabudua, kind of like, there's a system there, for sure, but it definitely looks messy, and it does not look, you know, at all like, if you go to their website and look at the photos, it definitely looks different than that.
What is a moat in these areas? I mean, you have the actual like investment infrastructure, but also there's just the brand. And what value do we give the just the simple brand of JD? And I think that matters quite a bit in these circumstances.
I think JD does have, it's better probably, we've probably asked Michael, you know, if you do market research and ask people about what they think of when they hear JD and kind of what the value is there. I mean, for me, it's a little safer, you know, the quality you're going to get is probably better. There's frequent, you know, you can tell when you buy something, you can return it. Sometimes on Taobao, you can't do that. You know, but compared to Tmall, Tmall has a quality it's like you're buying direct from a brand that was allowed to open a Tmall shop. And if you're like familiar with that brand, then, you know, that's where you're going to get. So, you know, when I buy things on Jingdong, it's because I think I'm going to get it faster. If you buy it on Taobao, it could take a week, could take 4 days, could be faster. But if you talk to the seller, you can get them to send it in like a faster way. But they're included in the price, you know, delivery cost is going to be the slow version. You know, it's going to cost a little more on JD. And because of that, maybe that's why you get it faster. You know, maybe that's why you have kind of a little bit better quality. If I was buying like white good, like any refrigerator or appliance or anything, I mean, definitely buy it on JD as opposed to a random shop on Taobao. It'd definitely be cheaper on Taobao, but I just wouldn't do that.
All right. Our time here is hitting at an hour 20. Michael, do you have anything
The only thing that I would add to this conversation about the relative advantage of JD Logistics versus other logistics services, particularly those that are Alibaba affiliated, I think that for US-based investors that for reason of the pandemic have not been able to set foot in China in the last 2 years, need to appreciate is that JD does not have a monopoly on same-day delivery. This is a misconception that many folks who ask for my time have, is that they believe that JD commands this same-day delivery space, and that is untrue. If, for instance, you are buying things that are, you know, general knickknacks for your house and you purchase them through Tmall supermarket, it can be delivered same day. If you're in a pinch and it's absolutely hissing down with rain outside and you need an umbrella delivered to you, you can buy one from Meituan and get it hucked over to you within 30 minutes. So this idea or this notion that, oh, hey, JD is the place that you go for same-day delivery and that all of its commerce is built out of that promise, I think that particular model of JD or that conception of JD is built on a number of faulty assumptions. If you have those assumptions, please check the math on that. It's just flatly not true. And so the delivery standard is improving. Consumer expectations of delivery are increasing. But what you find, and if you look at overseas, Amazon has had same-day delivery for a while, and it has built itself out of that particular promise. is that e-commerce platforms are now starting to train the consumer to actually expect next day delivery, because same day delivery is very nice from the consumer point of view. It makes a little less sense for business, and so what you have is you get to a point in time where you will see some of these platforms install next day delivery as standard, and then I think the same day delivery will come with some additional price attached to it. There's a long road till we get there, but I do think that that is something on the horizon. So yeah, the only thing that I wanted to chip in with the JD conversation is really just around this notion that it has a monopoly on same day delivery. If you've got that, dispel it as quickly as possible. It does not give you a factually correct, consistent interpretation with what's happening on the ground.
So as kind of is a continual theme when it comes to e-commerce in China, is whatever advantage a certain platform has usually doesn't last more than, you know, a couple of months or half a year or a year before it is something that is pretty prevalent across all platforms. That is kind of I think a pretty consistent theme that we can take away from all this. But anyways, let's wrap things up for today with all this. So if anyone wants to follow any of us on Twitter or any other social platforms, make sure to follow China Tech Invest on Twitter. But you can also follow me at Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTZAAGMAN. James is JAMESHULLX, James Hull X. And Michael, you are, say again?
Brief Norris.
Okay, that is his underwear as well as his last name. So, all right. Thanks again to everybody at Techno and to all of our listeners for listening in. And we'll catch you all next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now.